AMATS committees, but what you'll see in there in the mail packet is the draft project listings. There are a few changes that will occur to those because we have to meet fiscal constraint. And so there are a few projects that might get pushed back a year or even may get like pushed off of the TIP for now, but they're still on it in our minds, you know. And those projects really are just a culmination of projects from like our 2021 and our 2023 funding rounds. These are projects that were approved for funding before, and then that allows them to be on the TIP. So pretty straightforward this time. We'll talk a lot more about it in March. That's when we'll be going for public comment, and we'll be sharing the full document and probably walking you through that in more detail. But for right now, are there any questions about that draft project listing that was shared?
I did just want to make a comment. I was glad to see the Veterans Trail projects. Those two separate projects were still listed in 2027 and hadn't been moved back. I wanted to check with you all if you'd heard anything, any progress on moving those projects forward.
I believe the next draft of the TIP will show that those projects are getting moved back, but only for fiscal constraint, and then they get moved back in when they're able to sell. At least the Stowe part of the veterans, we've heard very little. The last thing I heard was the summary that Ron wrote.
Yeah.
Thanks
for catching us up, Ron.
Yeah, I think
I'm glad somebody read it.
Yeah, well, no, and even Jim McCleary sent it to us and said, this is like a good summary of where things stand. So congratulations, Ron.
Thank you.
But unfortunately, since then, with the current federal environment, I think everything is going to slow to an absolute crawl, at least until people in leadership positions. And by that, I don't mean, the Secretary of Transportation, but when he gets all his people in and then the rank and file start getting guidance, because what we're hearing from our folks at DOT right now is just, we don't know anything. We're waiting from leadership, to give you guidance. So,
Curtis, you just muted yourself.
Sorry, I was trying to let Amelia in.
Oh.
Sorry, I forgot my Word computer and I was downloading it all on my Mac again.
No, you're fine. No, that was my fault. But anyway, I don't know where I accidentally hit the mute. Basically, we're in a wait and see mode on almost every federal program. And until we get more guidance, we're moving along as business as usual. But we fully anticipate that it won't be business as usual as we get more guidance. And Matt will talk about that a little bit more specifically in our item 3D.
Curtis, can I ask a question?
Oh, go ahead, Ron.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead, Austin. You're probably going to ask the same question.
Oh, well, it's not it's related to TASA grants, but not specifically the Veterans Trail. I noticed that it seems like there's a lot of TASA projects listed for this year and maybe more spend anticipated than funds available by maybe $1.5 million or something.
Potentially
one something point. In there that AMATS was maybe looking for loans or something to cover that in the interim.
Yeah, we're looking for loans, but at the same time, we were just notified that the Akron Rubber City Heritage Trail was being moved back to fourth quarter, which got us a little bit concerned that maybe they're not hitting their benchmarks. So, but it was done by ODOT, not by us. So we actually have a note at our next review meeting to talk to Akron and ODOT about why it got pushed back. Mm-hmm. Because what we just need to know is, do we need a loan for, $700,000 or $1.4 or whatever it is. So that's kind of where that one stands right now.
Okay. Thank you.
So I did have a different question. Curtis, I thought I heard you say with regard to those two projects that they were going to move back. And then I think you said they might be moving out.
Yeah. So I just wanted to, and specifically, when I said two, it's really, it's the one project that's the primarily from veterans. It's the, I think Graham, you know, like roughly Graham North to
the Stowe bike.
I believe it's that. So we have to show fiscal constraint in our TIP, which means that the TIP can't be more than 15% over programmed from what our available funds are for the next 4 years. But AMATS, as you guys know, we've had these conversations. We regularly over program at 20 or 25% just because projects tend to slip. So, which is fine and everybody's fine with it. But when we have to do our document, we have to pull a couple projects out just so that we can show that we have the money. And then as those projects get developed, we amend the plan and, or amend the program and bring them back into the TIP. So as long, you know, if like the rail line all of a sudden became available, it would be, we would just do an amendment, pull it back in and then have it ready to go. So on our internal sheets, we still kind of have like a highlighted spot that it's supposed to be sold in 2027, but it's going to wait, you know, but we won't pull it probably back in until we know for sure that we're actually going to be able to do it. But, you know, we let the project sponsors know, they're aware of it. They're like, yeah, we get it. This is, you know, it's kind of happens because there's projects on the roadway side that we have to do this with too. Like just kind of, you know, if the TIP says 15% over program, but we over program 25, it's like we have to like pull 10% of our program out. And so, every time I slide over to admit someone, I mute myself. But so it's not meant to be an indication of project delay. It's just, you know, kind of a accounting format.
And it doesn't have to go back through an approval process then?
No.
It's kind of like grandfathered in.
Yeah, it's like the money is already there. So so it's allocated. You won't see it like our funding sheets. You won't see it like disappear. It's just for that 4 year period, we can only show our total program plus 15%. And reality, there's about 25% over programming in our plan. So, or in our program. So it's real wonky. And the only reason I even brought it up is because Austin, you said you were glad to see it. So I wanted to warn you that the next time it might not be in there.
Okay.
So don't think it's actually disappearing. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you say just pull it out, like it'll just drop off the list and then.
Okay. And then we'll pull it back. But on like our table 3C that we all have in all of our packets, it still is on that list. So you'll still see it there.
Okay.
And what you described is just for that one project. It's not for the other project that goes from Springdale North to.
Yeah. And honestly, to be honest, Ron, I know it's one of them because our TIP coordinator was talking about it. I don't think it's both, but I can't, unless I could see the, if I can pull up the, I'll let you know. How about I just shoot you an email and let you know which one got pulled back?
The one from Springdale South was approved first, I think in 2021. And then those ones from, Springdale North was approved in the next round.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you'd do it based on the order.
It would probably be based on whichever one was already sitting out in the further year, but were they were both in 27, weren't they? Was one of them?
I seem to remember Amy reaching out to Jim McCleary, although that may have been on another project. So if it was this project though, that would make me think it's the Southern leg.
Yeah.
But I can't remember either. The other thing I'll say, Ron, is this project is one of, I don't know, more than half a dozen that we had to do this for to show fiscal constraint. And these are all projects we know are moving forward and we know they're going to happen. But they were just, you know, for various reasons, easier ones to kind of push back, ones that were
They're essentially on hold anyway. So
Right.
I get it.
Yeah, but the funding doesn't go away. I mean, the only way the funding would go away would be if Metro or, you know, the feds just said like no, or if they say you have to spend $6 million on the corridor, and Stowe then said fine, we're done. Like those would be the only reasons the funding would go back in the pot. But I don't think we're there yet. I hope not anyway. But you know, Ron, your email wasn't overly optimistic, I thought, you know.
Try to describe it the way it is.
Yeah.
Can I slip another question in here?
Sure.
A little bit different. Austin and I had been meeting with Boston Heights, and they had some funding for what was called the Heights to Hudson Trail.
Yep.
And we found out in December that their city council kind of pulled the plug on that and said, we're not going to do it. Was any AMATS funding in that package?
We were not funding that. We were supportive of it and we were hoping to see it happen. You know, that was the one that had, you know, the Turnpike agreement, I believe, for the, you know, at the end of the day, I think part of it was, I think, you know, there's some issues with the city of Hudson and Boston Heights right now in terms of, I think, one suing the other or something like that.
Yeah.
About an unrelated issue. But I think there was some concerns that if Boston Heights built something, there were council people that thought it would never end up getting connected to anything. And that seemed to be one of the things that bothered them. And there was some local share on the table, obviously, but I know I heard from the consultant, you know, they were trying to convince them to do it. And at the end of the day, they just decided that it was a bridge too far, no pun intended, but that they were, they weren't going to fund it. So it doesn't affect our program, but it does kind of put into question, you know, where that Heights to Hudson, you know, at least for right now, I don't think it's going to be something at the Heights part that advances relatively in the near future.
So you may not know this. The investigation I did looked like they had a $500,000 Clean Ohio grant and a $250,000, I'll call it an earmark, from Bill Raymer. I don't know if there was other funding or not. I had heard numbers of like $1.9 million. But my question is, if those funds are not going to be used, can we get them somehow?
I wish. No. So the Clean Ohio goes back to the state Clean Ohio pot. And if there is an earmark, that thing's going to sit for God knows how long before it gets released. And that money is like, I don't want to say it's unrecoverable, but it goes into the black hole of like federal omnibus extra accounting stuff. Like we'll never see it.
Elon Musk gets it then.
Yeah. Elon's already stopped the payments. Like.
All right. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay. Well, so two things. One, Seth, I want to just make sure we're recording. I hit record and I'm seeing a red. Okay, good. Okay. The other thing I wanted to just introduce really quickly, we have a new staff member, Amelia Hoffmeyer, who's on your screen. She joined our staff here in January. We're really excited to have her. She is going to be doing a lot of GIS work in our office, working closely with Seth. So all those cool maps you guys see in all our reports and stuff, we're going to have even more power to do more of those. So, and Amelia, you'll get to know this crew here, but, actually, all of the folks who are here are kind of regulars who we see at some of our most of our CIC meetings. And so just wanted to say welcome to Amelia, and hopefully you'll be seeing her more on these. The next thing on our agenda is the draft, again, this is like a draft project listing for Transportation Outlook 2050. So every 4 years, we update our regional transportation plan. We've been working pretty heavily on that over the last few months. And we have a very similar schedule on that to our TIP. So we'll be going for public comment in March also. So there'll be a lot to talk about at our March meeting, I think, between the TIP and the plan. But anyway, in our packets, what we included, and I'm very embarrassed to say, I haven't even told you this, Curtis, yet, but a couple folks came up to me after the meeting. Somehow when I was transferring over the list from the working spreadsheet we had to like the prettied up one that went out, certain cells didn't copy correctly. Something happened. I have no idea what. But so there are some incorrectly listed projects, some amounts that were wrong. Like most things are correct, but there are some that aren't there. So it's a not quite complete list of what our draft projects are. But when we get that corrected, which hopefully will be tomorrow, what we're looking at is a list that's yet to be fiscally constrained. So we know that our wish list is much bigger than the money we expect to receive. And especially with costs going so up so much so quickly over the last 5 years, just our costs of preserving the system, of maintaining the system, like resurfacing a road, reconstructing a road, building a new bridge, those kinds of maintenance activities have gone up so much that we could easily have the needs with preservation eat up our entire budget. But we know we want to do other things. Our communities want to do other types of projects that improve safety, that improve walkability, whatever. So the hard work now is going to be over the next month trying to come up with a fiscally constrained list. And so what we're asking is for our members, our communities and our agencies who have projects to kind of review the list, make sure that the projects there seem reasonable, the budgets seem reasonable. Of course, that'll have to wait another day because there are a few inaccuracies on that list. But that's kind of where we are right now. But stay tuned for March. We'll have a whole lot more information on that. But are there any questions on that initial look at the plan's project listing? Or even just questions about the plan itself?
One comment I'll make, it looks like glad to see the Veterans Trail on that list. It seemed like the southern end of that was ending at the Freedom Trail. And I just wanted to make a comment that I would love to see that connected over to Northside Station.
Somehow I've seen that before, Austin. I don't know if...
Yeah, don't get me started on the connection to the Northside. The Freedom Trail itself was supposed to go to the Northside
Station. Well, I know that, yeah.
It's like...
We know that story, Curtis.
Yeah, it's still very irritating to me, but, you know... Because we paid for the bridge over Howard Street. So, like, that's kind of sitting there waiting for a connection that's not there yet. So,
I'll just add, we did, back in December, Jerry Egan and myself met with Kyle, the planning director.
Yeah, Kyle Julian.
Julian, correct. And Mr. Volman, and we talked about that piece, and their comment about that was they would like to see that done because there is a bridge there to connect to the towpath trail, and they would like to see a connection to the I'll call it the Main Street Trail. They've worked kind of long and hard to get a trail along South Main Street down there, and they'd like that to connect to the to the Veterans Trail and the Freedom Trail. So if that piece was done, the nice thing about that is it kind of makes a loop around downtown Akron. It's more of a triangle shape, but it would be formed by the Veterans Trail across the north, the Freedom Trail coming kind of across the south, and then the Towpath Trail going up the west side there. It'd be like a 6-mile loop around downtown, which I think would be great for people who wanted to go out and run on their lunch hour or take a bike ride around downtown. It'd be a nice connection all the way around. So it is the goal of task force to get that piece. We'll continue to work on that.
Yeah, I've got a note for myself that I'm going to check it. I've actually been back and forth a lot with City of Akron officials over the last, the last week or two on kind of fine-tuning their projects and stuff. So I'll mention, just kind of talk about what their intentions are for the limits and where they'd like to see it end up, knowing that you're supportive of that. I mean, it makes sense to me. We might have to amend project costs and stuff, but we'll definitely look into this and certainly pass along that you at Task Force are certainly in favor of this.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Any other questions about transportation outlook and the update to that? Okay, our next item is, Curtis is going to take this. This is a resolution that he worked on with supporting the region's efforts to develop intercity passenger rail service to the greater Akron area.
Yeah, so I know that this was, I believe, Matt, correct me if I'm wrong, but this was discussed at CIC last month, correct? In December, you guys touched on it at least.
Yeah, Dave Mangold was there, and so he asked, he noticed it in the policy agenda. So, yeah, he brought it up and we talked about it.
Yeah, so back in 2022, under the Biden administration, that there was a corridor ID program for intercity rail. Ohio applied for a couple of different corridors. Three of them got funded. The biggest one, or probably the one most well known, is the 3C plus D, which is the Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, and Dayton. Back in 2024, in about June, Congresswoman Amelia Sykes and the Ohio delegation wrote a letter saying that they wanted to see the Akron-Canton area be a part of that 3C plus D. After that letter, the DOT responded, or ODOT responded, saying that, you know, they couldn't do that because there are a lot of challenges with Akron and intercity rail. Biggest challenge being the rail doesn't exist. In terms of anything that would be able to carry a class one passenger rail service. So we had a discussion because what we realized for our long range planning is that in the last plan, we didn't even discuss passenger rail. This was primarily because of the environment. You know, it was 6 years before in 2014, the Kasich administration, after the Strickland administration had gotten $500 million to build a rail line for the 3C, the Kasich administration gave it back. And it was kind of just one of those things that it kind of was like the writing was on the wall that, you know, rail was sort of DOA in Ohio at the time. So, you know, in the last year, it's been kind of interesting to see this get revived, or this idea of the 3C plus D. I did tell our technical advisory committee that I feel like, in a way, this resolution is moot because I don't anticipate there being any, you know, new start passenger rail in the next 4 years. It might even be unlikely that the 3C plus D would even get funded. I mean, obviously, that's just speculation. But what our policy committee wanted to do last month was to at least pass a resolution. They asked us to write a resolution that stated our support for passenger rail, our willingness to work with partners to explore passenger rail, and our willingness to help partners apply for grants if any do become available. And so that's essentially what this resolution does. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, Rick. You're muted, Rick.
That's what I'm quickly running around. How do I unmute?
Yeah.
I was looking at the minutes of the policy committee meeting and saw that discussion about that. And I thought, gosh, that's more discussion than any of the meetings I ever attended took place. it's of interest to me. Now, did you say it was ODOT who kind of said that it would be tough to add Akron to the CCC+D? Is that right?
Yeah, ODOT? So it was a letter from Director Marchbanks, the previous ODOT director.
Oh, okay. And a couple of things interested me. It said, well, we don't have adequate railage now, but Akron has had Amtrak in the past.
It has. The old, from like the early 90s, there was a Amtrak spur. What they were discussing specifically was the ability to connect into the 3C+D. So I think there was a concern about they brought up that they said that the existing facilities aren't available to support it. Due to cost, travel time increases, and the additional mileage. Those were the three reasons given. And so I think when they're talking about the connection into it, we're kind of they weren't thinking about going towards Cleveland. It was a thought of to go west. You know, like, is there any availability of rail to go westward to connect into the 3C+D versus us being like a, you know, I don't think the intent was for it to be like a commuter line from Akron to Cleveland to Columbus, because frankly, I think that the ridership just wouldn't be there with the inner city rail.
With the inner city rail from Akron to Cleveland to hook up rather than.
Yeah. Open. Versus a direct west into the actual line. Get to Columbus, you know, so because if you went from Akron to Cleveland, like the amount of time it would take you to get to Columbus would be probably 4 hours, you know, or something like that. So that's a challenge. But, you know, I think the reality is that the investment that is going to be needed is it's going to require local, state and federal. And right now, there's not a high level of confidence in either the federal or, quite frankly, like the state was willing to do the 3C and the other corridor study, but they would have to put in quite a bit of money to actually build the passenger rail. And so it's really unclear how much further the state's going to take this as well, at least until the study's done, you know. And so really, and what we've said to our partners is that we really believe one of the best things that can happen is that if the 3C+D is built, you know, and actually is operational and works, that's really the best thing for rail in our region, because then all of a sudden it lights a fire to connect to it. But unfortunately, ODOT didn't really see a logical connection into the corridor as is for Akron.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things I read in the other minutes was maybe somebody from ODOT said, because one of the ideas I gather is to put a station at or near the airport.
Yeah, so that what was interesting was that what we've been told, we had a conversation with the Ohio Rail Development Commission, and they told us that rail to the airport is not actually eligible to be included because it is not inner city. You know, the purpose of inner city rail is connecting cities to cities, and they're more meant to be those long range or long, you know, connecting large populations. And so they said that under the federal program, a termini of the airport would not be considered like an inner city rail connection, was what we were told by ODOT.
Oh, okay, so that was the discussion, having a terminus at the airport rather than having the Cleveland, Akron, Columbus, Dayton go by the airport.
Yeah, and I will be honest, it was a little bit of a, you know, conversation that was kind of spinning around a little bit. But the mayor of Green was the one that had said, you know, he really wanted rail to the airport. And that's where we were kind of just letting him know that according to ORDC, like connecting into the 3C+D to the airport is it does not sound like it's a viable termini. So you know, yeah. if it's part of it, it's not a bad stop, but it couldn't be the, it couldn't be like the terminus.
The terminus. And that's why I was bringing it up, because one of the responses I saw was, well, there aren't many Amtrak stations near airports. And I thought, well, there's a good reason for that. All of the Amtrak stations were built in middle cities 100 right. years before there were any airports. Yeah. So
right.
it struck me as a bit dismissive. Rather. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, and I think, I don't know. I mean, and again, I can only go with the guidance that the Ohio Rail Development Commission had told us. But I think that the challenges right now is just the, I mean, I think we're going to get this resolution approved, but I think it's going to be a very slow crawl to potentially ever seeing passenger rail just because of a lot of those challenges. And like we've been talking about, you know, the Amtrak service itself. I mean, one of the reasons that it left Akron was because of low, you know, basically low ridership. And the reality is that, you know, our central cities have just gotten less and less dense and less of an activity center than they were in the 90s. And so, you know, kind of going to that comment about the rail or the airport is that, you know, is the central city of Akron really the most convenient place to be getting on and off inner city passenger rail? Because there aren't a lot of great connections unless you can get to, say, like the transit center or something like that that can get you throughout. I think, unfortunately, our region as a whole is just not well, you know, we're not built at the level of density that's going to be overly supportive of rail, which is a, you know, it's just kind of stinks if you're a rail advocate.
yeah. Which I was looking before the meeting, you know, and it's okay. You look at the cities that are being talked about. And I hear what you're saying with respect to the next 4 years, probably not much is going to happen on any of this anyway. But you know, if this, what are the two, you know, the 3C plus D, and what's the other one? Going through.
There's a Cleveland, Toledo, and then there's one that's a Fort Wayne to Columbus to Pittsburgh was the other one, I believe.
Right. And so between those three, you know, Akron Canton, that, you know, as y'all know better than I do, you put those two together and that would form kind of the fourth largest municipal region in the state, right after the top three, Columbus, Cincinnati.
Yeah.
you know, so it strikes me that a station between the two would be beneficial.
And I don't think anybody thinks that if the rail existed, that it wouldn't be beneficial. I think the bigger issue is just the overall cost. And the reality that with all the as Matt kind of going back to even our long range planning, like in some ways, the infrastructure bills of the 1950s and 60s, you know, we have got a ton of roadway infrastructure to maintain. And the reality right now, at least from a federal deficit perspective, is there's not billions of dollars sitting in a pot to build a world class rail system to go along with the world class highway system. And so it's really more about opportunity costs, I think, than it is about, you know, it's like if we could build everything, I think people would want it. If we could build a great rail system, we would want it. The reality right now is the money's just not there. I mean, what we're seeing, even just to preserve our existing system, we don't have enough money projected in revenues for our region to maintain the federal roadway system. So when you start talking about your rail, you're talking about billions of dollars of investment over an operating cost. It's just, where is that money going to come from? And I think that's kind of the bigger overarching issue, is just how likely is it to ever take off the ground? If it manages to take off the ground, I think we'll start seeing a stronger funding support for it. But right now we just don't, there is no great pot of money that's going to help us build passenger rail.
Yeah. And I know others have questions, but this is why I'm so interested in rail. Just kind of to your point, Curtis, it's like okay, over the past nearly 70 years, we have put trillions of dollars into an interstate system that has obvious advantages and is expensive to maintain. And a lot of it was put there so that folks could move out to the suburbs. And now we don't have the money to build a world-class train system, which is putting us behind other countries. So anyway, that's a bigger issue, I know.
No, I know. And Matt and I have had these conversations too, where it's like, you know, you when you have had the opportunity to experience world-class rail, there is nothing better. There is no better way to travel than having a world-class rail system. And it's so, you know, and even in the U.S., when you get to places that have at least some rail and some subway on the East Coast, it's good. I mean, it's still not, I wouldn't say it matches, you know, the Deutsche Bahn or, you know, anything like that, but it's good. And then we get out to Ohio and we're just even now so, you know, because of the highway system, we're so dispersed that we don't, it makes it hard to retrofit, you know, it's crazy, but now it's hard to retrofit in something where we got rid of rail lines that did exist before. You know, abandoned rail lines. And I think there was a really good article that Ken Pendergrass wrote in the Northeast Ohio Transportation blog. I don't know if you've ever looked at that, Rick, but he kind of talks about the history of rail in Akron and why the connections are hard to make because of when Akron was developed and when the rail. And it was just, I mean, not like saying yay or nay, but it was an interesting kind of history lesson on the way the city of Akron and the region kind of developed. And how we were at the wrong time to get those rail lines that were like those perfect, you know, like a 3C plus D. Like we just weren't there to benefit from it. And the ones we had, we abandoned and lost. So, you know, it's plenty of challenges. And I think for our staff.
You hit your mute again, Curtis.
Every time I have to admit someone, I mute myself. But I think the reality is that, you know, it's a money problem. If we as a country wanted to build high speed rail, we could do it, you know, but we'd have to sacrifice something else, or at least the quality of something else at this point. So it's a challenge.
In Columbus, like the second largest city in the nation that doesn't have rail service, is that what I've read?
I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me if it's true.
Yeah, I get it.
If I remember correctly, Vegas and Columbus maybe were up there.
Yeah,
it would make sense. I mean, it would definitely make sense.
Thanks for answering all that, Curtis. I appreciate your.
Yeah, sorry. And if you want more information, or, you know, I can try to send you some of the. Because I think I even have the letters still that were sent between Sykes' office and ODOT. If you want those, I could share them. Because those give a more detailed explanation of, you know, the reasons behind, or the thought process behind both camps.
Gotcha. Yeah, that'd be helpful.
Okay. That's all I got on there.
What's that?
So that's all I've got on that.
Okay. All right. So the last thing, speaking of interesting topics, you know, let's talk a little bit about funding and what we know and what we don't know. So obviously some pretty big changes here in the last few weeks. And I think Curtis hit the nail on the head at the beginning when he was just kind of talking, summarizing like that we don't know a lot, but we have senses of where things are going, and we know what the current administration is saying through their executive orders and rescinding past executive orders. With all of that, we've been reaching out to ODOT and Federal Highway to try to get like more, I guess, guidance on how we should interpret that. Because if you look at some of the rescissions of previous executive orders or the new executive orders, you know, they do directly affect our planning work and what we're planning for and how we conduct our planning. There also was some worry a couple weeks ago when there was the funding freezes. I think that kind of scared everybody in the country, not just in the transportation world. And that was a short-lived thing. But with all of that in mind, like, we don't have a lot of information right now. All of the agencies that we've spoken to have really said, for now, keep doing what you're doing. Expect that there will be changes, but until some of those top positions under the new transportation secretary get appointed and everything, I think we're all kind of just in a wait and see mode of what these things look like. Some basic things of what to expect. We do expect some process changes in how we do our planning work, like I said. I think with that, there's a pretty clear de-emphasis on environmental justice and also just general environmental type issues. Anything having to do with climate or electric vehicles, that sort of thing. I think we're seeing some pretty huge changes there. There's a lot of language in what we've seen. We were given some information. The transportation secretary published a memo last week, and then that went to the DOTs, and that was then sent to us at the MPO level. That kind of gave us some ideas of where things are headed. One of the big things was, a lot of basically removing anything that has to do with race or anything like that. There's a real big focus now on funding preference to communities with marriage and birth rates that are higher than the national average. So we're kind of following that. And so just generally, we expect a lot more clarity in the next few months as some of these positions get appointed. So we'll probably have more information on that in March also. But the clear advice we were given from both the Federal Highway Administration and ODOT was to kind of continue advancing our programs consistent with what we've been told to do before, until we're told otherwise. So that's where this stands right now. It's kind of a strange time because nobody really has any answers. But in a way, that's also comforting. Like I told Curtis last week, it was like a daily thing trying to interpret what's happening. It's like I actually feel a little better not understanding what's going on, knowing that even, the real high ups at ODOT and Federal Highway don't really have much more than they can give us. So that's where we are right now. But if there are any questions about that or things you've heard that you want to discuss them, we'd be happy to discuss what we can.
Yeah, and Matt, I thought, to just be kind of illustrative or to give kind of like an example of what we're kind of talking about with the uncertainty is that, a lot of the large federal discretionary grants in the last 4 years, the applications required things like, proving that you weren't going to impact the carbon, climate change. They were based on, the population of low income and minority households that were in your region. They were giving points for things like if you were putting in EV charging stations. And so when the executive order comes out now that says, we want to pause all federal transportation dollars that go towards, climate initiatives, DEI, environmental justice, I think that was the three. But the reality is that now projects that have those funds that were awarded by the DOT, say, 2 or 3 years ago, that they're now getting ready to ask for federal authorization to go into construction, they're not clear on if they'll be authorized to proceed, or will they say to the community, well, you need to take the EV charging stations out because that's anathema to the current executive order, or will they just say you're not getting this funding anymore because when you applied, you said it was going to be a benefit to climate change or to, you know, we gave you this money based on things that now the executive order is saying we can't make those decisions based on those things. So a lot of the biggest confusion right now for communities who have some of this money and they're about ready to build it, but they got it under the last administration and they're not clear on if the current administration will allow them to continue to proceed with using those funds. Because our funds are sub-allocated to us and we get to choose where those funds go, we're pretty confident that we're not going to run into any issues with our TASA, STBG, and CMAQ funds. But for communities that, say, might have infra or RAISE or, you know, safe routes or safe streets for all or
reconnecting communities. Akron just got the $10 million.
They're not confident that will they get federal authorization when they move forward on this project. And so that's where a lot of right now the uncertainty lies. And then in a few months, we're going to start getting direction where maybe our funding policy is going to have to change, because if, you know, we have an executive order that says we need to, you know, consider birth rates or marriage rates in our region, that's something that we'd have to somehow consider in our scoring for awarding federal jobs. So I just wanted to try to illustrate kind of what, when we're saying, oh, we don't really know what's going on, it's like those are the types of questions that we're getting asked by communities and questions that we want to know the answers to.
And a lot of credit to Curtis. This was all coming out last week and the week before, just as we were like hitting huge deadlines with our TIP and our plan. And we were all, I mean, it was a busy week on top of, you know, even without all of this stuff. But Curtis can really geek out to political stuff and understanding policy and stuff like that. So there's a lot of work behind the scenes to try to get the information that we even have now. There's just a lot we don't know yet. So stay tuned on that.
I don't want to dominate, but I have a bunch of questions.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So I'll just hit it random here. When it says projects will need to look at or communities that have high birth rates will be favored, just what the heck does that mean?
We don't know at this point. So there's in the DOT memo, there is a reference to like higher than the national average. Now we haven't been able to really get into those numbers, and to be quite frankly, it's not data that AMATS has ever collected before. So we're not, you know, where if you were saying how many carless households are, like we, you know, we look at that data for our whole careers, but when you say what's the birth rate or the marriage rate, you know, that's not numbers that we're as familiar with. So the way that it was worded in the DOT memo was that to the extent practical, relevant, appropriate, and consistent with law to mitigate the unique impacts of DOT programs, policies, and activities on families, family-specific difficulties such as accessibility of transportation to families with young children, and give preference to communities with marriage and birth rates higher than the national average. But what some of people were talking about too is like, we're not even clear where that, if there's data available, say like by region or by, you know, is there a database that has Stowe's birth rate or Cuyahoga Falls's birth rate and, you know, what the averages are. And so that's the stuff that that's the language that we've been given so far, but we would anticipate within a few months' time there being some actual guidance of how you would go about giving that preference, if that makes sense.
So in essence, it's saying, so the first step is
to the extent that DOT requires this information as part of what they need to make decisions as to whether they get money or not, just having getting that data is step one, and that data is not readily available.
The data, yeah, well, and quite to be quite frankly, like at our at our level, the data is not something that we've ever looked for before, and we're not ready to start jumping into it until we get a little more guidance on what all that means. Really, what when the secretary sends out a memo like this, he's trying to kind of, you know, he's giving the federal DOT guidance on when, you know, because right now, if you think about it throughout the year, there are federal grants that are currently open, right? The window is currently open and someone can apply right now for certain types of grants. So he's trying to get out the message very early to say, you know, to the extent that we can, these are the things I want you to award funding based on. But there's not much we can do with that until we really, you know, until we get more guidance from the DOT of what that looks like. So I'm guessing that the data is available somewhere. It's just not, you know, I don't even know. I mean, I'm assuming the census has birth rate, but I don't know at what level it would be or how detailed we can get it at. So, and again, at this point, we don't really, as an MPO, have to do anything until we get more of that guidance.
Did it strike you at all odd that your transportation decisions might be based on birth rates of individual communities? Or does that connection?
What we flagged it for is that I would just say that it's definitely language that we have not seen before. That's probably the best way to say it. It's a new focus area that we have not seen before, at least from a true policy perspective.
Well, as you look forward, let's say, okay, the data becomes available and you and ODOT and others start writing your proposals, you know, for federal funds, including this data. How's that going to play out? I mean,
yeah, so I will say, like, I read an article in Newsweek, and it was the only article I could find that actually referenced some, like, birth and marriage rate data that they had gotten, I believe, from, like, the Pew Center or someone, you know, but it was older data. It was probably from 2017. Okay. And what they pointed out was that typically rural America and suburban America have higher birth and marriage rates than urban America. So to me, you know, it looks like whereas before under the last administration, there was definitely an emphasis on the environmental justice, low income minority. This seems like it's a more of a focus on families. If that makes sense.
Okay. And then,
I mean, maybe that's not a good question. If that makes sense.
So it won't necessarily be on need or improving something environmental, you know, improving the environment or improving access to transportation by folks who don't have access now. It'll simply be based on who has more babies.
Possibly. I mean, I will say, just in fairness, you know, it does say that they want DOT policies to focus on families and family specific difficulties, which they do say, such as accessibility of transportation to families with young children. But then it's and give preference to communities with marriage and birth rates higher than the national average. So there is some mention of access to transportation along with families with young children.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And then here again, I'll pause if others may have questions.
I think it's your show.
There's a lot to unpack here. And so with respect to, well, I'll go to DEI. I don't understand the connection between whether or not ODOT or you or cities and so forth have DEI initiatives or not, and their transportation needs.
Well, I think the connection for the feds is that I'm going to take a step back. So, and I'm not, I have read the executive orders on the, you know, getting rid of the DEI stuff. I think one interpretation, and I'm not saying this is the interpretation, but is that, you know, when we are looking at need, that it is would almost be considered discriminatory to look at need based on race or income. Does that make sense? You know, and so the concern then would be one of the questions is that if that's what the executive order says, does that mean that does that mean things like when we do right now, our agency does something called an environmental justice analysis that specifically looks at roadway projects and how they may impact lower income people and minorities. But the question would become, is that in itself discriminatory in some way? And that's what we're not clear on right now. But it creates, you know, and so if the Fed thinks that, then that would become a qualifier for getting federal aid. And, you know, and if ODOT is still doing environmental justice and the feds are saying environmental justice is now discriminatory, you know, ODOT would not be getting their federal funds because the Fed has that ability to, you know, withhold funds based on their priorities. Now, again, there's even more confusion because then you get into what's actually written in the surface transportation bill, the BIL or the IIJA, the AIJA, the last transportation reauthorization, because some of the stuff is some of the language is actually in the law and some of the language is not. And so then you get into that. That's where you hear a lot about people talking about court cases because, you know, at the end of the day, someone might say, well, wait, the law said you were supposed to spend this money on X and now you're trying not to, you're breaking the law. So that's where some of this stuff is kind of like we assume is going to end up in court at some point of how much the feds can withhold funding based on executive orders versus the law itself. And those things are uncertain.
Okay. Y'all got your work cut out for you, don't you?
Yeah. And I mean, and it just in all truthfulness, you know, we are working with sort of half information. I mean, we have, you know, we have a memo, we have some executive orders, and I'm sure if anyone's ever read an executive order, they are incredibly vague, you know, purposefully vague. And then usually the details have to kind of get filled in by, you know, the bureaucrats at Federal Highway and at FTA and for our stuff. And so we're just not at the point yet where those, you know, that stuff's been filled in yet to know how to interpret it. But I think there are concerns that, you know, some federal funding that was committed could be clawed back, but those really right now are just sort of conjecture and speculation.
So it seems like you've had a set of criteria, whether, you know, environmental justice, you know, the impact on environmental justice, whether it mitigated that or not, the impact on the environment, the needs of a community with respect to transportation, the needs of the transportation system itself. So you've had kind of a set of criteria. It strikes me that
many of those criteria are either being turned on their head or tossed out altogether, which would strike me as difficult to adjust to. I mean, even if you don't like criteria, if you have known what they are and you've been operating under them for years, maybe you'd say it's the devil, you know, and now all of a sudden you toss all that out.
Yeah.
Are you wondering at this point what the criteria are going to be?
Yes. I mean, and I think you nailed it on the head, is that, you know, environmental justice itself was an executive order from Bill Clinton in 1994. Since that time, so for 30 years, there's been, you know, hours and hours of training and questions and time spent on environmental justice. And, you know, it's telling in a way that even people at DOT that we've reached out to, you know, they're not, even though the executive order has been rescinded, there are people at the DOT that are like, wait, we're not comfortable telling you that you shouldn't do that, even though the executive order has been rescinded, because we've been doing it that way for 30 years. So I do think that that's accurate of like, okay, you know, and again, and it was an executive order. It was not the law of the land, so to speak. But what we're, I would say longer term, what I would say people, agencies like us, what's the struggle now is that because executive orders in general are being used more as like policy tools, we're more likely to get, you know, swings back and forth every 4 to 8 years. You know, I have a hard time believing that there's going to be an executive order that lasts for 30 years again, just because, you know, it's become sort of a hammer in terms of new administrations to establish priorities. And so in some ways, it's, you know, now I'm looking back and we're saying, man, I'm surprised Trump didn't do this in his first term. But he let it, you know, let the EJ continue. But so I think we're, you know, I mean, there's still all sorts of, you know, laws that prohibit certain types of discrimination and things like that, that, you know, DOT will have to follow, and every federal agency will. But I could see this kind of changing, especially in the margins of our programs, of just what are the emphasis, you know, when a community writes a grant for federal dollars, it probably, the application is going to look a lot different than it did last year. And so that's an adjustment. But I would say in my 20 years, and that this is probably the most drastic departure from, you know, past practice to current practice.
Interesting stuff.
it is, and as Matt said, like, there is a nerdy part of me that's just fascinated by the whole thing and the use of executive orders, what's written in the law, you know, these memos from departments, and there's still things that we haven't even heard about yet, you know, that maybe like aren't getting a lot of attention right now, but maybe will be in a month, you know, like things like environmental, the EPA and e-check, and, you know, our region's been in non-attainment since the air quality amendments of 1991. There's nothing saying the EPA won't come back and say, you know, we did have this standard, but now we're going to make the standard a lot looser. And all of a sudden there's a whole set of regulation that we used to be doing that would disappear. So that's sort of, you know, it's, those are things that you just kind of brace for and wait to see where everything falls. But I think the biggest thing is for our members, you know, everybody wants to know what it means. They want consistency, and they want to have they want to know, you know, from application to application, from, you know, every time they receive a dollar, what to expect. And right now we just don't have that. And so I think it's natural with the new administration that there is going to be a little turbulence along the way.
Right, right. And you kind of spoke to, and something I was going to ask, I can imagine any new administration creates some of this uncertainty. Is this the same as past administration changes, greater than in terms of the amount of?
Yeah, I would say for us, it's a little bit stronger. You know, we'd never seen like an attempt to freeze all federal funding. That's something that's new. And therefore that was probably a bigger jolt. The EJ stuff, I mean, I would say it was surprising, but it's also, you know, in some ways it's very bureaucratic. It's very much about, you know, things that us in the technical, you know, analysis world, it's stuff that we do. But the funding freeze was the one that was really, I think, there was a lot of initial shock, because it was just everyone trying to figure out what it meant and were reimbursements going to come through and things like that. So I would say probably a little more than the previous 4 years, but mm-hmm. But that was probably more so for the one that ended up being rescinded. So yeah. Or it was rescinded, but it wasn't rescinded, but it right. was rescinded, you know. Yeah.
And if you say that was a significant shock, and is there concern that these sorts of sudden shocks will continue to experience?
I don't think so. I mean, I think what we tend to see in every administration is you see like this heavy hand sort of, you know, this we're going to show everyone that we're doing something, big announcements. And then, you know, it's really the devil's in the details. 2 months from now, 3 months from now, how do they ask us to be, you know, interpreting these pretty vague orders? And that's where we might get, you know, that's where I think, you know, in May, that's where we might say, yeah, it's really been a big change. Or we might be able to say, you know, in the end, like they still want us to do X, Y, and Z, and it's not that big of a change. So it really is going to take some time. It's probably a better question that can be answered in March or in May when we have a little more detail. Right now, it's more like the announcement and you're reading stuff and trying to piece it together. And we could be jumping to conclusions that aren't really there, if that makes sense.
Do well along those lines. So I hear what you're saying is, any change in administration involves these sorts of uncertainties. Also, are you saying this is probably a unique example of that? And some uncertainty as to, you know, what future shocks might hold. Do you sit down, find yourself saying, okay, what's worst case scenario here? And
how do we prepare? Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, for us, the worst case scenario is that at some point, you know, that the federal government and our representatives don't value regional planning. You know, that's the worst case scenario. But, you know, they've valued it for 50, 60 possibilities. Years. Yeah. Yeah. And at this point you can't for sure say, oh yeah, you know, I don't think anything is like nothing at in the governmental world now. I don't think anyone can be like, oh yeah, we're safe because of X, you know, it's just a different world now. And, you know, everything that someone might think is wasteful is on the block. So, you know, we're mandated by federal law, but that federal law in 2 years could change. And I think, you know, so I think our role for our communities and for our agency is to continue to put projects on the street, make significant change and add value to our region. And that's what we're trying to do.
Gotcha.
Is Amex scheduled to update the funding policy guidelines this year ahead yep. of the next round of funding? Yep. And if there's any significant changes to, I guess, the guidance on how projects should be awarded, would that be
well
taken care of when that's updated? Or do you expect that would need to be updated ahead of schedule?
No problem.
I think we wouldn't have an issue. I would think that my hope is that we'll get the guidance we need and that we'll include whatever we're being told we have to include in that funding policy update. And again, just because, you know, it's right now for us, it's just hard to know. You know, it could be something that they want us to consider it, and that means we're writing a narrative and saying, hey, these are the information and we take this into account. Or it might be something where we're going to have, you know, a you know, you have to score projects and you must consider, you know, there's a lot of difference between shall and consider and, you know, you should. And so at this point, we're not sure, but I think we will be, I think our timeline will align well with making sure we have that stuff in there.
The timing of all of this is really good for our funding policy guidelines, and it's really poor for our transportation improvement program and our long range plan, because the work that we do in those is, a lot of it is based on some of the things that are being clawed back. But yeah, for funding policy guidelines, I think we're set up well to be, you know, looking at that over the spring and the summer. All right. Well, that's what we had on the agenda. I know we're already at 7:40, almost at 7:45 here, but are there any other questions or things that anyone wanted to bring up?
I just wanted to express my thanks to all of you for everything that you're doing and trying to figure out what's going on. So thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks. We appreciate it. And Rick, I'll try to send you that information for the letters of support on the rail stuff. All right. Well, thank you, everyone. We really appreciate it. And have a wonderful evening.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Good night.
See you guys.